greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on story time when we come back. Well, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it. A Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that government does to produce, to prepare, or to deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor guy make 38% profit on that pizza that he has to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we all buy? Well, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we told you a couple of stories, one about Emil Crow and Dennis, the distressed property story. You ever heard people say there ought to be a law? How many times have you heard somebody say, oh, there ought to be a law? Or where is a cop when you need him? Well, when I was a kid in high school, we had a civics class. Mrs. Lowry taught the civics class. Mrs. Lowry was as dumb as a box of rocks. It was the first incompetent teacher that I'd ever run across. Up until I got to the ninth grade, my teachers were all competent until we got to Mrs. Lowry. That woman had no business being in the education field. I mean, she was the blind leading the blind, if there ever was one. But, you know, she was tenured. She'd been a teacher for many years. And in her civics class, she was constantly telling us about how the Congress enacts laws and how, you know, people come up with neat ideas, and then these neat ideas need to be incorporated into law. And so we went over this lawmaking provision, you know, in the Congress. How do they do that? And the committees. And then the president signs it into law. And then there it is. And the policeman goes out on the streets and he enforces it. Here in America, we have 2.5 million laws on the books. God, there ought to be a law. That's the watchword in America. There ought to be a law. And by God, we got a Congress there that's making them for us. Now, Americans used to believe in a thing called limited government. Limited government means limited law. If you want an all-pervasive government, well, then you want more and more laws. More and more rules and regulations. More and more people telling you what to do and how to do it. Evidently, that's what we want in this country. That's what we have. Under the old limited law theory, we had all the laws that we needed in the Ten Commandments and the Statutes of Moses. There is a total of 759. In every state in the Union, they have more than 2,000 traffic statutes. 2,000. Now, our Creator runs the entire universe on 759 laws. Hell, your state can't even run their traffic, for crying out loud, in less than 2,000. And, of course, you signed your driver's license. Do you remember that? You signed your name. It's right there on the license. You signed it. That's your signature. That's your agreement that you will obey all the laws of your state, all the traffic laws of your state. So you signed up and you agreed to do that. And I've asked people when they come to class, do you think you know all 2,000 of the traffic laws in your state? I'm waiting for the first guy to raise his hand and say, yes, I've studied all 2,000 of the traffic laws of the state of New Hampshire. I know them all. And I follow them religiously. Hell, we don't even know what these laws are. The average guy couldn't find them. If I said, where are the laws of New Hampshire on traffic code? They wouldn't have a clue. They got a license. They drive a car. They think they know. I guess they must think that they think that they think they might know. Well, there's an old story that goes along with this thing of there ought to be a law. It's called the Buzzard Story. The Buzzard Story comes out of Idaho. And one time there was an old rancher, and this old rancher, he's gone down the road here one day, and he looks off into the field, and he sees what he thinks is a dead cow over by a water hole. He's out on the range is where he's at. He's not in the field, per se, but he's out here on the range and driving down the road. So he drives on over to the water hole, and sure enough, there's not only a dead cow, but there's an old sow bear and two cubs eating on the carcass. And he sees that old sow eating on that carcass, and it just incensed him. He's just meaner than cat dirt, you know. And he said, that damn bear killed my cow. And there she is, big as life, eating it here down by the water hole. And he says to himself, you know, there ought to be a law against these damn bears. So he calls his representative. He goes up to Boise, and he sits down there with the representative, tells him his problem. He says, you got these bears running all over out here, killing our cattle. And so the representative, he's got a very attentive ear. He can see bureaucracy at work here. And so the representative says, well, let's see what we can do about this. And so he goes into the committee, and the committee says, well, yeah, what we need is a law here that creates and establishes a government hunter who will go out into the woods and hunt down all the bears. Why, we can hire hundreds of these government hunters. Why, we can tax the people, and we can transfer that money from the people to the government hunters. And the government hunters can go out and kill all the bears. The bears will then not be killing the cattle. The cattlemen will all be happy. And we can get votes from everybody. And so they passed the law. The governor signed it, and they created a bureaucracy. And sure enough, they got a government hunters program, and the government hunters went out, and they killed all the bears in Idaho. And it worked. Because once they killed all the bears in Idaho, there were no more cattle killed by bears. God, it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? And so the rancher was happy, and the government hunters, they were happy, and the politicians were happy, the taxpayers were happy, and we got a bureaucracy here, and we got more laws on the books. And well, one day, now that the bear problem had been solved, the old rancher, he's driving down the road, and he goes by that same water hole. And he looks out over there, and he sees what looks like a dead cow. He drives over. And sure enough, there's another dead cow over there, and this time, there's a pack of wolves eating on it. And he says, well, look at that. Damn wolves came over here, and they're eating on my cattle. So he goes to the legislature, and he says, now listen, we've got a problem here. He goes to his representative. He says, the wolves are out here killing my cattle. And so the representative says, well, we got a solution to that. We got government hunters. What we need to do is to put these wolves over here on the list of predators that need to be killed in order to protect our cattle. So sure enough, you know, the legislator, he goes to the committee goes to the House and the Senate, and the legislature passes the law. They put the wolves on the list. Governor signs it into law. The government hunters, they go out, they kill all the wolves in the state. There ain't a wolf left in the state of Idaho. Killed them all. But hey, listen, it solved the problem. There has not been a single cow killed in the state of Idaho by a wolf in over 50 years. Makes all the sense in the world. There aren't any wolves. How in the hell could there be any losses to wolves or bears, for that matter? We got rid of them all. So, everybody's happy. Politicians happy. Taxpayers are happy. Government hunters are all happy. Cattlemen are all happy. And it's another example of a law put into operation that solves everybody's problem. So, one day, the old rancher, he's driving down the road, and he looks out over there at that water hole again, and he sees what looks like another dead cow out there. So he goes out there and he takes a look, and my God, there's coyotes all over that carcass. And the coyotes are eating on the carcass, and the guy is just livid. He goes back to his legislator. He says, hey, listen, it's got another problem over here. Coyotes now. The coyotes are killing our cattle, and they're eating them. Politician says there's no problem. He goes to the committee. The committee goes to the Senate and the House. They pass the law. They add the coyotes. They get the government hunters up to kill every coyote in the state. They're out there poisoning them. They're out there shooting them. They're out there killing coyotes like you can't believe. Pretty soon they kill all the coyotes. Solves everybody's problem. Hasn't been a cow lost to a coyote in 50 years because there aren't any coyotes left. Kill them all. No coyotes, no wolves, no bears. I'm telling you, this law thing just works like a shot, doesn't it? It solves all of our problems. If there's a problem, pass a law. We got to get the government involved in this. If we can get the government involved in this, the government will solve our problem for us. There ought to be a law. So one day, the old farmer is driving down the road again, and he looks out there, and he looks and he sees what looks like to him to be a dead carcass out there by the water hole. He drives over to the water hole, and there it is, big as life, a dead cow. And this time, there's about 30 buzzards all over the carcass, and the buzzards are eating the carcass. And the old farmer says, well, for crying out loud, the damn buzzards are down here killing my cows. So he goes to the legislature. He goes to his legislator, and he says, the buzzards are killing my cows. Legislator says, there's no problem. He goes to the committee. The committee passes the law. The law goes to the House and Senate, and it's approved, and it goes to the governor. The governor signs it. It goes out to all the hunters. All the hunters start shooting all the buzzards. They're poisoning all the buzzards. They kill every buzzard in the state of Idaho. Now there's no buzzards, and there's no coyotes, there's no wolves, and then there's no bears. Now, so far, we haven't solved our problem with dead cattle, because when we got rid of the bears, the wolves were killing them. When we got rid of the wolves, the coyotes were killing them. When we got rid of the coyotes, the buzzards are killing them. I mean, you know, we still got dead cows out there. We haven't solved the dead cow problem, but boy, we solved the bear, the wolf, the coyote, and the buzzard problem. We ain't solved the dead cow problem yet. But we got rid of all the buzzards. They're not killing cows. We got rid of all the coyotes. They're not killing cows. We got rid of all the wolves. They're not killing cows. We got rid of all the bears. They're not killing cows. We've still got dead cows. We don't have any wolves, coyotes, bears, or buzzards. One day, the old farmer's driving down the road. He looks out, and sure enough, it looks like he's got a dead cow out there. He goes down by the water hole, and he looks at this dead cow, and it's just covered by flies. I mean, there are just millions of flies all over. Big, green blowflies. And the old farmer says, oh my God, now look what's happening. The flies are attacking our cows, and they're killing them. He goes to the legislator. He says, we got to have a law against the flies. The flies are out here killing my cows. Legislator says, no problem. He goes to the committee. The committee passes a law. They add the flies to the list. They give a fly swatter to every government hunter. They give a fly swatter to everybody in the state. People are out there just swatting flies everywhere they can find them. They're poisoning flies everywhere. We still have dead cattle. We haven't been able to figure out what's killing the cattle, but we know it's not the bears. We know it's not the wolves. We know it's not the coyotes. We know it's not the buzzards. And now we know it's not the flies. I mean, after all, there aren't any flies left in the old state of Idaho. We swatted them all. One day, the old farmer is driving down the road. He takes a look out there, and he looks like what he sees is a dead cow. He goes over to the water hole. And he sees this dead cow. There's no flies. There's no buzzards, coyotes, wolves. There's no bears. But the carcass just seems to be disappearing. And he doesn't understand why this carcass is being consumed. It's just disappearing. There's no flies, no buzzards, no coyotes, no wolves, no bears. But there's dead cows. By now, there are dead bones, there are dead cows and bones scattered all around the water hole. So he takes a sample of the cow, and he takes it down to the university. And he said, analyze this sample and tell me what's wrong. So they analyzed the sample, and they said, this cow is being consumed by bacteria. Right away, the farmer says to himself, what we need is a law against bacteria. Obviously, the bacteria must have killed my cow. And because the bacteria are killing cows, we need to eliminate bacteria. Now, this was a little bit over the top for everybody concerned, the legislator, the hunters, the fly swatters. And so they went a little deeper, and they looked at the tissue, and they found out that the tissue was filled with alkali. And they came to the conclusion, by scientific experimentation in this case, that the cow had died from alkali poisoning. So the old farmer, he goes out, he takes a sample of the water, he brings it in, they test it, and sure enough, the water hole is poisoned. Yes, sir, the water hole is poison. It's alkali. And what's happening here is that as the cows come down and they drink out of the water hole, it kills them, and they die. And the bear came along to eat the carcass because the bear is a scavenger. The wolf is a scavenger. Coyote's a scavenger. The buzzard's a scavenger. The fly is a scavenger. The bacteria are scavengers. These were made by God to clean up the dead bodies. But the old farmer, you see, he thought that these scavengers were killing his cows. In law, we call this assuming facts, not an evidence. And so, instead of revelation, we go with scientific experimentation. We kill off all the bears, it doesn't solve the problem. We kill off all the wolves, it doesn't solve the problem. We kill off all the coyotes, it doesn't solve the problem. We kill off all the flies, the buzzards. Hell, we could kill off all the bacteria. But it isn't going to solve the problem of cows dying from a poisoned water hole. And that's the buzzard story. Now, let's take a look at something a little bit more down to earth. How do you deal with government agents? You ever have a government agent raising hell with you? He calls you on the telephone and he says he wants to audit your books. I had that happen to me one time. Guy's name was Rod Johnson. He was with the Department of Labor in Boise, Idaho, down on Idaho Street. And he called me one day. In fact, sent me a letter. He said, we want to do an audit. So I called him on the phone. I said, what seems to be the problem that you want to conduct an audit here? He said, it's just routine. Just a routine audit. And I said, well, if it's just a routine audit, then you must have a reason for doing this routine audit. How did you come to select me? He said, we just selected you at random. Now, see, I'd already been through about two or three audits recently, and I thought, talking to my old buddies, you know, around town, or the businessmen, you know, talked to Dick Alloway, and I said, how many times you been audited over the last 10, 15 years? I said, I haven't. So I went down to George Hodge. I said, hey, George, how many times have you been audited over the last 10 years? He says, well, once. Down to Jackson Machine. I said, how many times have you been audited? He says, well, I haven't. He said, I got audited one time. It was a long, long time ago. And I got to thinking, I've got about three or four audits over the last year or two. And here's my old buddies around town, you know, and they've been audited about once every 10 years, maybe not at all. I said, uh-huh. Sounded kind of like discrimination to me. Now, the government agent, he can't very well say, well, we don't like you, and we're trying to drive you out of business, sucker. And so we're just going to audit you to death. We're going to find something wrong with you, and then we're going to fine you. And we're going to harass you until you finally give up and quit and leave town. I mean, they can't do that. They do that all the time. So if you didn't think that the government agents out there were out to get you, well, they're out to get some people, not everybody. Especially people that open their mouths and give them some static. You know, if you get to be a squeaky wheel and you start demanding a little extra oil over here for that squeak, you know, then right away them bureaucrats, they want to get after you. And this is why the laws are kind of bad. The more laws you have, the more law enforcement you have to have, and the more law enforcement you have to have to enforce all these laws that you got, the more time you got to put in law enforcement officers that get angry with you. And that want to use their power to hurt you. That want to use their power to dominate you. I mean, that's just natural. It's just the way human nature is. You give a man a little bit of power and he'll abuse a little bit of power. You give him some more power and he'll abuse some more power. You give him absolute power and he'll become absolutely corrupt. He'll just absolutely corrupt and misuse his absolute power. It's just natural. It's just normal. That's the problem with having too many laws. That's the problem with let's have a law. Or there ought to be a law. Because the more laws you have, then the more abuse you have. And the more abuse you have, then the more tyranny you have. I mean, if you want more tyranny, what you need are more laws. And Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and Ted Kennedy and George Bush, they're there to give you more laws. Homeland Security, so that when you go to the airport, you can take your pants down, they can look up your crack. Take off your shoes. Gotta have more laws so we can protect you. Well, okay, you know, we've been through this, you know, for thousands of years. There have been threats to people's lives, liberties, and their property and their houses, you know, for thousands of years. And government never ceases to amaze me. They've always got a solution. What we need are more laws, more police, more surveillance, more control, and we can give you more security. This goes on, it goes on, goes on. And pretty soon the people get tired of it and they overthrow that government and they put in something new. Sometimes it gets a little better, sometimes it gets a little worse. In the case of Cuba in 1959, they went from bad to worse. In the case of America in 1776, we went from worse to better. But the better has over time become worse. You know, it's gotten to the point where today you've got more and more laws, 2.5 million laws. Rod Johnson, he's just enforcing one more law. It's the unemployment law. It's the labor laws. And so he's got to audit my records and books. And this, of course, takes time, effort, and energy from me. And what he's looking for is crime. He's looking for something that I've done that didn't follow the law to the letter so that he can fine me. so that he can put another notch in his gun. Hey, I brought another businessman to ground. I mean, I found this guy breaking the law, and I prosecuted him, and I convicted him, and I put him in jail. Now, we got laws where years ago we didn't have any laws, like the seatbelt law, for instance. You know, before you put seatbelt laws in, you didn't have a seatbelt violation, did you? And so seatbelts may be a great idea. I'm not sitting here saying that they're not, but, you know, did you need a law to put people in jail because that they didn't buckle their seatbelt? And so, you know, probably registering your car is a good idea, but do you need to put people in jail because they don't register their cars? Because they don't have a driver's license? These are called victimless crimes. We just create laws for the purposes of creating laws so that we can keep people employed. Rod Johnson wouldn't have a job if he wasn't down there enforcing and auditing and prosecuting labor laws. Building inspectors wouldn't have any job to go to if we didn't have building codes and building laws. So we create all these laws so that we can create employment for people. I mean, if you didn't have child laws, you know, like child protection laws, what would social lady do? She'd be unemployed. So the social lady has to have laws to enforce. So we have to have laws that say, well, you can't whip your kids. You have to send them to school. And you have to raise your kid to these state standards. And you got to get them shot up with monkey pus and snake venom. And if you don't do those things, well, then you're in violation of the law. Well, now, with that little understanding out of the way, Rod Johnson now, he wants to audit my books. Now, I took a look at this and I said, you know, I think Mr. Johnson needs to obey the laws just like I do. And, you know, it isn't enough to just send me a letter. I mean, you got to have probable cause. So I knew a little about the law, and so I sent him a letter back. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I want you, to come in here with probable cause. I want you to dot your I's, and I want you to cross your T's. And I want you to follow all the procedures that are required. Boy, did he get mad. Why, he just came unhinged. And so he brought up a contempt citation, and he brought me in before Judge Schmidt. And so we went into Judge Schmidt, and so I came in there in opposition, and I said, this guy doesn't have probable cause. And we went at this legal battle, and we fought this legal battle for about, oh, probably 6 months. Probably. And then we went back and forth. We probably had 4, 5, 6 hearings, and we'd come into the hearings, and he didn't dot his I's and cross his T's, and I'd point that out, and the judge would order him to dot his I's and cross his T's. And God, he got mad. He was a lawyer. He was an accountant. Why, he'd been to college, had degrees after his name, letters. He probably had pieces of paper on his walls, and here comes this high school dropout and makes him cross his T's, dot his I's. He was just livid. I don't think he liked me very much either. So this went on and went on and went on for a long time. I was kind of having a good time at it. And he just getting meaner and meaner and madder and madder. And finally, one day, we got to the end of it, and he dotted all of his I's, crossed all of his T's. Some months had gone by. Several hearings had gone by. And pretty soon, the judge came down with an order. And on the order, it said, and on the 13th day of June, 1978, then and there, in the office of Rod Johnson at the Department of Employment at 1347 Idaho Street, you shall deliver to Rod Johnson these 6 items. And he had about 6 things down here. I think it was the checkbook, disbursement journal, and canceled checks for the last 3 years. And some other things over there. There was 6, 7 items there in the list. And so I got my court order, and I had the court order in my hand, and I had about 2 weeks to get this stuff together. And we left court, and Rod Johnson had clearly won after 6 months. He clearly won, and we're now going to have to be audited. Isn't that just real special? All right. Well, there's more to the story, so you stand by while I give you this reminder, and we'll be back with more on Rod Johnson and the Department of Labor right after this. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed to the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station, although they should. And if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're back with the Rod Johnson story on story time here on the Law Hour and editorial review. Well, now, Rod Johnson has a court order that says George Gordon and the Atlantis Manufacturing Company Incorporated must deliver then and there to the office of Rod Johnson 6 or 7 items for him to audit. So, on the 13th day, at 9 a.m., I had to be there at 9 o'clock. I showed up about 15 minutes early, and I took 2 witnesses with me, and I had a suitcase, and I had all the things that the court order called for, you know, like the time cards and the checkbook disbursement journal and the other documents and records, you know, that we were supposed to have. And so here comes 9 o'clock, and Rod Johnson doesn't come out. Now, the secretary said she'd take it, and I said, oh, no, I got a court order here. I mean, I got to follow the court order. So she said, well, Mr. Johnson's in a meeting, and I don't know when he's going to be out of the meeting. And I said, well, you know, it says I'm to deliver these to Mr. Johnson at 9 o'clock, and so I'll just wait for him. She said, well, you could have a chair over there if you'd like to. You can sit down. I said, thank you very much. And so there we were, patiently waiting. 5 after 9, 10 after 9, 15 after 9. Pretty soon it's 20 minutes past 9. And I was planning on leaving at 9:30. I thought, you know, I got here 8:45. And Mr. Johnson's supposed to meet me at 9. That's what the court order says. And he didn't meet me at 9 or 9:15, but at 9:20 he came out. And there he is in his full regalia. You know, he's wearing his 3-piece business suit, like all lawyers do. and is double breasted, and he's got a vest and, you know, wingtip shoes. And he says, "Well, I'll take that." And I said, No, wait a minute. You can't just take it now. You gotta go through the list. I mean, the judge, you know, he gave us this list, so." So I put the suitcase up on the secretary's desk, and I opened it, and I said, "Now, Mr. Johnson, you see on the list, it says time cards. Do you see time cards in there?" He said, Yeah. And I said, "There's the checkbook disbursement journal. You see that?" He says, "There's the general journal. You see that?" And went down the list. And I said, "Now, do you agree that everything that's on the list that the judge has ordered, I have appeared in your office and delivered it for your inspection, and have you looked in that case, and have you seen everything in there?" And he said, "Yes, I have. I closed it up, I picked it up, and I walked toward the door." And he says, "Where are you going?" I said, "Going home." And he said, "Well, leave that suitcase here." I said, "I'm not leaving the suitcase here. There's nothing in the court order that says leave it here. It says you're to deliver it for inspection. I delivered it, you inspected it. Now I'm going." And he said, "You've got to leave that for the audit." And I said, "Doesn't say that in the court order." And he said, "Well, I'll have you for contempt." I said, "Well, get after it." And I walked out. Now, I followed the court order. And that's what the court ordered. And by golly, that's what I delivered. Now, Johnson comes back with a contempt citation. So it isn't very much longer until I've got to appear in court before the judge and show cause as to why I shouldn't be held in contempt of court because I didn't follow the court's orders. Well, that's what Johnson said. And so I took my witnesses and I went into court. Took another month, you know, to get the case scheduled for a hearing again. We're not going to trial now, going to hearing. And so the judge, now he was kind of shocked to see me back in here again. And so he said, "Now, Mr. Gordon, this is a show cause hearing as to why I shouldn't hold you in contempt of court." He says, "Can you show cause as to why I shouldn't hold you in contempt for not delivering those records and books to Mr. Johnson like he said?" And I said, "Yes, sir. And I'm here today with witnesses, evidence, and testimony with an offer of proof to show the court why I'm not in contempt and how I followed the court's order to the letter." And I said, "And I'd like to call my first witness, Mr. Rick Hosbach." Now, the judge is faced here, you know, with taking testimony. I mean, we're going to spend several hours in here. And the judge would kind of like to avoid that if he could. And he said, "Now, Mr. Gordon, maybe we could save a little time. Why don't you just tell me what happened?" And so I said, "Well, sure." So I just related to the judge essentially what had happened that day. And the judge was just looking at me like, "Oh, my God, I can't believe what I'm hearing." And so he looked at Johnson and he said, "Well, now, is that essentially what happened?" And Johnson said, "Yep, that's what happened." And he walked out and he didn't leave the records and books. So the judge, now faced with little Georgie Gordon playing sandbox. And I wanted to point out that, you know, when it comes to playing sandbox, little Georgie is the champion of sandbox. So, you know, when a government bureaucrat wants to play sandbox, you know, well, okay, you called the right guy. I learned to play sandbox with Ronnie Mitchell when I was 4 years old. You want to play sandbox? Little Georgie's the kid to play sandbox with. So Judge Smith, he's sitting there, and he took about 15 minutes. And there was all this deathly silence in the courtroom as the judge sat there on the bench and rewrote the order. I mean, in longhand. I mean, he wrote out the order, took him about 15 minutes. And then he read the order. And the order said essentially what it had said before. It said, that on the 10th of September, then and there in the office of Rod Johnson, you shall deliver, and he listed the things over there. But he added added one line, and he said, "And leave them there." And so here's the new court order, and then he had his secretary type it up, and I received it in the mail, and Mr. Johnson received it in the mail. And when it's all said and done, along came the 10th of September, then and there, in the office of Rod Johnson, I had to deliver this suitcase with all these things in it. So about a quarter to nine, I arrived at Mr. Johnson's office on the 10th of September, or whatever the date was. And so we arrived with my two witnesses, and of course the secretary, she called Mr. Johnson. This time he came right out. There wasn't any waiting. Why, he didn't stand me up. He didn't give me any guff. He came right out and he says, "I'll take that." And I said, "Hold it, Johnson. We got a court order." He said, "We've been through that." I mean, Johnson practically had an apoplectic fit. And I'm still hanging on to the case. And he just ranted and raved. And he was jumping up and down, pawing the ground, biting the bushes. God, he was just livid. He thought I was going to walk out of there and not leave that case. So I said, "Now let's calm down. Calm down now. Everything's going to be all right, Mr. Johnson. We're going to get through this. It's going to be okay. Just relax." So I put the case up on the secretary's desk. I opened it up and I said, "Now, Mr. Johnson, do you see time cards in there?" And he was really short. "Yes, I see time cards in there. And you better not walk out of here with that either." I mean, I think that he was suspicious that I was hiding something. I think that he thought that because I worked so hard to keep these records and books away from him, he just absolutely knew he had me dead to rights. That he's going to find crimes and criminal behavior, and that he's going to lock me up in prison forever. I guess I was acting a little suspicious. Fighting tooth and tong. I mean, I kept these records and books away from him for months and months. I made him dot his I's, cross his T's. I made him have an apoplectic rage. And so he went through the list, and I closed up the case, and he's still ranting and raving about I better not leave. And I pointed my finger right at his nose, and I said, "Mr. Johnson, you win." And I turned around and I walked out. Well, I mean, after all, you got to give credit where credit's due. I mean, he worked hard for about 6 months to get those records and books. And I worked hard for 6 months to keep them away from him. Now, I knew and he knew and the judge knew and everybody knew that in the end, he's going to get those records and books because this is a corporation under Hale versus Hinkle. But, you know, you can't just call you on the phone, you know, and say, "Deliver them." He's got to dot his I's, cross his T's, and follow the law. And that's my point here, you know, that bureaucrats and government officials, they ought to obey the law just like all the rest of us. That they ought to have to go through all of the agony and all of the heartache and all of the frustration of trying to follow all of these crazy rules and regulations that are set down, just like we do. That's why I always tell my students, you know, make the government employee obey the law just like the government employee makes you obey the law. Don't make it easy for them. Make it just as inconvenient, just as nasty, just as ruthless, just as nonsensical, just as stupid for them as they make it for you. I mean, that's after all what sandbox is all about, isn't it? All right, now with that much said, I went on back to the office and I'm there in my office and I'm working away, and I don't know if it was the next day or two, I got a call on the phone and my secretary, her name's Candy. Candy came in, she said, "Mr. Johnson's on the phone." So I picked up the phone and I said, "Yes, can I help you?" And he was just as nice as he could be. He got over his apoplexy. He got over his rage. He was just very nice on the telephone. He said, "Well, Mr. Gordon, I'm here trying to audit your records." And he says, "Do you have a key to the disbursement journal?" Now, when he asked me that question, I didn't know what the hell the key to the disbursement journal meant. I didn't know what that was. It was some kind of an accounting term, I assumed. Now, you want to keep in mind that when you're the corporate head of a company, that doesn't mean that you know what's going on. Now, you know this Ken Lay over here at Enron, you remember it? Ken Lay said, well, I don't know what the hell's going on over here in the accounting department. I take their numbers and I assume they're telling me the truth. See, and you people thought that Ken Lay, oh, he's the chairman of the board. Of course he knows what's going on in there. I want to tell you from personal experience, the CEO of the company, he doesn't know what the hell's going on over in accounting. Hadn't got a clue. He's not an accountant. You know, let's be intelligent people. The CEO might be running the company. That doesn't mean that he knows how to put pistons into cylinder heads or cylinder blocks or put heads on the block. He doesn't have to be a mechanic. He doesn't have to be an accountant. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what the key to the disbursement journal was. I kind of figured, though, that our company controller, Milton Kagan, probably knew. So I said to Johnson, I said, now, Johnson, are you an accountant? And he said, yes. I said, well, Mr. Johnson, aren't you an attorney? He said, yes. So I said, well, why don't you just do your damn job? And I took that telephone and I slammed it down in the cradle. Made a lot of noise on my end. I don't know if it made noise on his end. But I think that Mr. Johnson got the message. I don't like you. Kiss my you-know-what. And so it happened that I had lunch that day with our company controller, Mr. Kagan, and we were sitting over there at Elmer's Pancake House having lunch. And he said, "Well, how did that meeting with Johnson come down?" And I told him the story. And he was kind of musing about that, and he was kind of chuckling a little bit. And I said, and a strange thing happened. I said, Milt, Johnson called me today, and he said he needed the key to the disbursement journal. I assume there's some kind of a code going on there. And Milton, you know, he was slurping his soup is what he was. He's an old Jewish guy from the Bronx. Called himself a kike from the Bronx. And he was retired. And he'd been in the pharmaceutical business. He was a real criminal. I mean, he wasn't a pretend criminal. He was a real criminal. He was a pharmaceutical salesman. He'd been selling drugs for years and years, made a lot of money. And he came over to the Atlantis Company when we got into trouble over the Joe Berry caper. And so he was running the day-to-day operations, the financial operations of the company. And he was doing a hell of a job. Hell, he had us making money in short order. That's why I always said I never met a Jew that couldn't count, never met a Christian that could. So if you got a problem in your business, you want to hire a Jew. They're the only people in the country that can count. And old Milton did, and he could count, and he had us in the black, and everything's going along pretty well over here. And so he's slurping on his soup there, and he said, well, he's not going to audit the books. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing from my company controller. I said, well, he's got the books. I had to deliver them to him. He said, well, yeah, he's got the books. He's got the records. But he's not going to audit them. And so I stopped eating, and I'm looking at old Milton. He's over there slurping his soup. And I said, well, what do you mean he's not going to audit them? And old Milton, he stopped eating. He wiped his chin. And he looked over at me and he said, because he can't read them. And I said, well, Milton, why can't he read them? Now listen, boys and girls, because this old Jewish accountant, he said to me. He said, because I keep those records in Yiddish. And unless he can read Yiddish, he's not going to audit those books. I couldn't believe what I heard. And he said, the law requires that we keep records and books. It does not require that we keep those records and books in English. And I don't. I keep them in Yiddish. And in addition to that, I keep the checkbook disbursement journal in my own code. And that's why he needed the checkbook disbursement key to the checkbook disbursement code. He needed the code to decode it. And you can't decode it because I keep it in Yiddish and I've got it in code. And we don't have to deliver the code. He's an accountant. He's a paid professional. He's supposed to know. 18 months later, we got a letter from the Department of Labor. It was one sentence, and here's what it said. It said, upon a review of your account, we have determined that there is no tax due. Got that, kids? No tax due. Now, the truth of the matter was, we were never short a nickel on our accounts. And we never cheated anybody, and there wasn't any need to audit the books. But here's the moral to the story. In order to keep bureaucrats off the streets and out of the pool halls, we need to keep them busy. We need to keep them occupied. We need to keep them employed. And they should be employed following all of the stupid laws, rules, and regulations that all the rest of us have to follow. And that's what we did. So there's the Rod Johnson story. Now, I've got a quick story here I want to tell you about how to count. Once upon a time, there was a little boy who took the family horse down to the farrier to have the farrier shoe the horse. Now, a farrier is a horseshoer, and he's a guy that puts on the horseshoes on the horse. There's four hooves on a horse. Each hoof gets a horseshoe. That's four horseshoes. Each horseshoe has eight nail holes. There are eight nails that go into each shoe. Eight nails times four shoes is 32 nails. I say that for all of you Christians out there that can't count. Not for you Jews. I know that you Jews can all count. So this is for the Christians now. There's an old adage, you know, that says the magic of compounding. It's the magic of compounding. Can you remember that, boys and girls? Can you say the magic of compounding? So the farrier says to the little boy, who had been given $12, which was the price for shoe and the horse, he says, I'm running a special today, son. And if you would like to have the special, what we do is we give you the horseshoes free. So he handed the little boy the horseshoes. He says, this is a special, the shoes are free. Now, to install, to put the horseshoes on, I charge 1 penny for the first nail, 2 pennies for the second nail, 4 pennies for the third nail, and we double it until we get 32 nails in. We're going to double it 32 times, and you get to keep the change and take it down and buy ice cream. I do that for all of the good little boys that bring their daddy's horses in to have them shoed. And the little boy, about 12 years old, he said, wow, what a deal. I get the shoes free, and it's only a penny for the first nail, 2 cents for the second nail, 4 cents for the third nail, and I get to keep the change. And so he said, yes, I'll take the offer. So the farrier, he puts in the first nail, and he says, okay, little boy, put a penny down there. He puts in the second nail and says, okay, little boy, put 2 pennies down there. He puts in the third nail. He says, all right, little boy, now put the fourth nail down there. So the little boy is putting down the pennies. And the way that works, it goes 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. So the first shoe that goes in costs 1 cent, 2 cents, 4 cents, 8 cents, 16 cents, 32 cents, 64 cents, and then the eighth nail costs $1.28. So at the end of the first horseshoe, it cost $2.55. Just add up $1.28, $64, $32, $16, $8, $4, $2, and $1, and it's $2.55 for the installation of the first horseshoe. The second shoe that goes on there costs $2.56, $5.12, then $10.24, and then $20.48, and then $40.96. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then it's 81-something or other, 81-80-something. So it'd be 80, and then 160. So it costs the second horseshoe that goes on there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 320. And so it costs about 600 and, just roughly $640 to get the second shoe on there. Remember, it costs $12 to shoe a horse. By the time we got the second shoe on, we're up to $640. We still have two shoes left to put on, 16 more nails. So if you'll take your Sharp EL1197 G3 Texas Instrument Calculator, and you start off 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, just write on your yellow pad 1 through 32, and just double that each and every time. And when you get to the 32nd nail, the 32nd nail costs $40 million. That's right, boys and girls. That 32nd nail is $40 million. Now, that's called the magic of compounding. Now, Americans have not been able to figure this out. And the reason for that is they don't know how to calculate compound interest. So when they pay interest, you know, they can have a credit card, and the credit card is at a discount, 15% interest. And they think, ooh, wow, it costs 28% interest for that credit card, but this one's only 15. This one is the better deal. That's true. A 15% interest credit card is a better deal than a 28% interest credit card. But does that make a 15% interest credit card a good deal? Because how long does it take to double? And the answer is, you take 72 and divide that by 15. And that's 4.8 years. That means that every 4.8 years that you're paying 15% interest on your credit card, the principal doubles. So if you got a $10,000 balance on your credit card, and you're paying 15% interest, that $10,000 will be $20,000 in less than 5 years. How do you like that, boys and girls? It's called the magic of compounding. And you learn that from the little boy who took the horse in to get him shoed. Penny for the first nail, 2 pennies for the second, 4 pennies for the third. And with that, boys and girls, we'll have to cut it off and remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.